Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Action Park Media.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment. Food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying this show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from. Today I'm joined by renowned gastroenterologist and neuroscientist Dr. Emron Mayer. We are going to discuss his new book, The Gut-Immune Connection, How Understanding Why We're Sick Can Help Us Regain Our Health. You can find him at emronmayer.com. Dr. Emron Mayer, welcome to the American Glutton Podcast.
Nice to be on the show.
I would love before we get into the gut-immune connection, can we just for the purposes of so I have a clear understanding and so everybody listening has a clear understanding, what is the microbiome?
So the microbiome is the combined functional capacity and the individual players, being the microbes, and the functional capacities, all their genes, the millions of genes, and all the enzymes and molecules that they can produce. So correctly, if you just talk about the microbes themselves, you should say microbiota. But I think microbiome has sort of become the general term that people use talking about this topic.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the way I've heard it explained previously is that the amount of mass, or like if an alien life form was to look at us, they would see much more of other stuff than they would of us, and all that other stuff is doing something. It's not just there by happenstance,
and it is ubiquitous, these microorganisms, you know, invisible to the naked eye. But certainly in terms of evolutionary history, they were the first ones. They lived to the billions or trillions in the oceans. They experimented with communication that ultimately became our neurotransmitters in the brain. And they're everywhere. They're on every surface. They're in the air. They're on animals, in the water, in the soil, play a big role in the health of plants. Yeah, so the microbes will always be here. You know, if you think about a nuclear disaster, it's not going to affect the microbes. They'll always be here.
Right. And so what you're dealing with really is how to have the most cohesive relationship we can with these little tiny guys that are having a great effect on us.
I think what's required is to become aware of it. Since we can't see them or touch them or communicate with them directly, I think we have to become aware that there is this system. And then we have to interact with that system in a rational way, which is based on an increasing knowledge base of what these microbes can do and how they can talk to our organs and what role they play in our health. The hard thing is, as I said, I mean, like, it's, you're dealing with something that you can't see. Just like with, I mean, most of these microbes we talk about are good guys, but then obviously also the bad guys, the microorganisms, you know, the viruses and the pathogens that can kill us and, you know, as we have experienced in the pandemic, can kill, you know, millions of people around the world, really. So
I think that's what I mostly think about when I'm thinking about the stuff that we can't see that's having an effect on me. I'm thinking about illness in very literal terms, not in an overall health sense, but in like, I'm very sick. There's something in me. And I need to either wait until it dies, or I need to take some, medication or like an antibiotic to kill it, to actively kill it. And yeah, it's never something I can see. It's just something that I get a blood test or a swab in my throat or up my nose or whatever it may be. And they detect it and then they give me treatment. So, you know, and I know kind of abstractly that there are good bacterias, but you know, I guess for my day-to-day life, I just go like, as long as I get some veggies, I'm good. I'm feeding them, you know, some cabbage, something that, you know, can be made fermented and still be good. This is how I think, like kimchi or sauerkraut are really active. So I can even eat that raw with a little salt and it's going to go to work and feed these guys. But apparently there's much more to be done.
Yeah, and that actually, you addressing a really good point, because, you know, in my new book, what I propose is a diet that's essentially based solely on what is the optimal diet for our good microbes. Because if you follow that principle, you know, it seems kind of crazy, but if you follow this principle, you will do all the good things for us, for our own organism as well. So I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, most people are obsessed with that they get enough protein, enough fat, enough, you know, carbohydrates, and what ratios are the best. All these macronutrients are absorbed in our small intestine. So they are of high caloric density. They're the overabundance of these foodstuffs is a main reason for our, you know, problems with obesity and metabolic diseases. So if you think about what do the microbes like and want, they don't want the things that are being absorbed in our small intestine. They want the things that go through our intestine are not being absorbed, are not high caloric, because then they are in their element. They can digest and metabolize these larger molecules, you know, which is fiber and plant polyphenols. So if you just think about that, if, you know, to provide the optimal diet for the microbes, it comes down to most of these things. These large molecules come from plant sources. So this whole argument, you know, vegetarian, vegan, carnivore, omnivore, is sort of defined by our own selfish, subjective obsession, you know, what's good for us. If you just think about what's best for some people call this the holobiont, the microbial genes and their functions and our host genes and functions. So together we function in an optimal way. And in this phase of human evolution, I think we have so much food around us that we harm ourselves. So we continue focusing on what's good for us. You know, we have to really think about that other side. And so conceptualizing something, understanding it, and something that we don't see, as we talked about in the beginning, is a key. So I think my whole thing starts with education. I think once people realize that, and I've spent a lot of time trying to change people's mindset on this, that we should move away from the purely, you know, selfish, subjective focus on, you know, what's the healthiest food for me, because there's even a larger dimension. These things that are good for our microbes are also good for things around us in the environment. You know, growing these high caloric foods is bad for the environment. I mean, you have to just the whole, you know, dairy and meat production obviously is a big cause of deforestation around the world. So if you think about, you know, feeding the microbes with largely plant-based food components, it will have the secondary benefit also for, you know, for the environment, for the health of the soil, you know. So it's kind of an interesting concept that, and I haven't always thought this way, quite honestly. You know, as a gastroenterologist, you're selfishly focused on the health of your patient. Right. But as I've progressed in my career, and particularly dealing with the microbes, I've developed this sort of one health concept. You know, it's just, if you think about health, there's more dimensions than just our own cosmetic, if you're obese or non-obese, or there's a lot more that's connected to this.
Right. But when we're thinking about the microbiome, and I'm sorry, I've already lost the more proper terminology, the nomenclature went right over my head, but
that's perfect. Perfect.
Okay. So when we're thinking about that, you know, because look, in fairness, I find it hard to imagine these microbes as being of having any value other than how they're affecting me. So it will still become selfish in my mind if I'm going, what's the point of feeding these microbes? Unless I can make some connection to what they're doing to me or not doing for me, and then go like, well, I want to put them to work doing something else.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so how do you find, as you said, that some of them you can track their interaction with specific organs, and your book is called The Mind-Gut Connection. Like, what's happening there? Are we talking about like hormonal things that these affect?
Yeah. So the, you know, my first book, The Mind-Gut Connection, is almost 5 years old now. It's interesting to me how this has become more popular than it was when I first wrote it. So this is the idea that started first with animal experiments that, you know, there's mouse models and of animals that grow up without any contact to microbes in a completely sterile, you know, so-called germ-free environment. And then people looked at their behavior, and so these germ-free animals were less anxious. And then you could actually put microbes from another animal that is very anxious into these germ-free animals, and then they would adapt the behavior of that donor microbe. So the microbes from one animal could transfer behavioral traits such as anxiety, depression-like behavior to another animal just based on the microbes. So that was kind of a revolutionary paradigm-shifting event. I was initially skeptical of that. Well, then we showed this also in human experiments that you could, if you manipulate the microbes, it has effects on the brain that you can measure. And in the meantime, we know quite a bit. We know that there's several communication channels between the microbes and the brain. So one is hormonal-like. So this means molecules that go through the bloodstream, systemic circulation from the gut microbes to your brain directly. So several of these have been identified, mainly in mouse models, since it's hard to do this kind of experiments in humans.
Right.
And then there have also been experiments that we can also now show in humans that microbes interact with the immune system in the gut. So the gut has another sort of unique property that most of our immune cells are localized in the gut, very closely adjacent to the microbes. And so certain microbes can talk to the immune system. And then the immune system, once activated, also gets into the bloodstream with inflammatory mediators and again can affect the brain on the short term, but even more worrisome in the long term. So if you have a long-term exposure of these immune molecules to your brain, it's a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and probably depression. So we have these hormonal substances, we have inflammatory substances, and we have a very important nerve pathway, the vagus nerve. So this is the nerve that connects the brain with all our organs, particularly the GI tract. And many microbes are able to talk to the nerve fibers, the terminals of this vagus nerve in the gut, and then a nerve signal is generated that goes into the brain. So we have at least three modalities or communication channels that can transmit signals from the microbes to the brain. And importantly, the brain has a way of talking to the microbes either directly. So there's receptors on microbes that respond to our own neurotransmitters. So the microbes know what our brain is actually thinking about. And there is another way the brain can do this. So when you're stressed or anxious, your gut goes into knots or contracts differently. That affects the habitat of the microbes that live in there. So they change their behavior in response to a stressful. So if you put this all together, what I said in the last couple of minutes, it's this circular communication system. You know, the microbes can talk to the brain in the short term, in the long term. And the brain can talk, like all your emotions always reflected or acted out at the gut microbial level.
Yeah.
Kind of the core, the centerpiece of my first book.
Yeah. And would this also, is there any evidence to show that this would also be responsible for some of the higher rates of autoimmune disease, especially in places like America or first world, quote unquote, first world countries?
Yeah. So this is a slightly different aspect, but it's also related to the microbes. So our immune system is being trained early on in life, the first 1,000 days in life, to differentiate between good and bad. And it's not a trivial task because throughout life, we're being exposed to all kinds of things. And for our immune system to know if this is a bad signal and they have to ring the alarm bells, or if it can be tolerated, is quite a training process. And in our more and more hygienic world, where we have eliminated exposure to natural, not harmful microbes, but microbes in the soil, on animals, on farm animals, in the milk, we pasteurize everything. So in the last 75 years, we have really declared a war on microbes in general. And, you know, even during this pandemic now, we had to do the social distancing and the face mask and constantly disinfecting your hands. That's even that war going into overdrive, you know, because we're not just killing the bad guys, we're killing everything. So our children grow up in a world that's has much, much fewer of these microbes that are kind of the training partners for the immune system. And so the immune system becomes less intelligent, less experienced in differentiating. And then all of a sudden, you know, allergies like peanut allergies or allergies to all kinds of food items that did not exist when I went to medical school. You know, it was completely... and initially were thought to be neurotic behaviors of people. But those allergies, based on a compromised training period of the immune system, because we're limiting the exposure to all kinds of microbes in our environment, that's a very serious thing as well. You know, right. It's a concept. It's not exactly the same as with. So, for example, I mean, as you can tell, this is a complicated area. So we have the early life programming phase, you know. Then we also have this problem with antibiotics, which also starts in early life. And, you know, children, I think the number is even by the age of two are exposed to at least five doses of antibiotics. And this leads to a decrease in the diversity and richness of our own microbiome. So any ecosystem, you know, like our microbiome, its stability and its resilience against disease is determined by its diversity. And so what we've done is with the antibiotics, and partly with our diet, because, we don't feed the same kind of wide variety of plant-based foods to our infants. They get lots of sugar, which is useless for the microbes. And so we have diminished the diversity and the resilience of that system inside of us for infections. And so there's people that have speculated with the pandemic, you know, that this decreasing diversity and resilience of our own bacterial microbial ecosystem in the gut is a risk factor for getting infected by the virus, but also having a particularly serious course or this long COVID, what's called, variant of the disease. And that has been predicted before the pandemic. So there was a really well-known professor in microbiology, Martin Blaser, who has predicted this in his book at the time, that we will be faced with increased number of pandemics because we're forgetting or neglecting the diversity and of our gut microbiome.
Right. I read that just through the drinking water, that even if you haven't taken antibiotics, traces of antibiotics can basically be found in all human beings, at least in America. I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but it was something about the amount of the medications that wind up in the groundwater, and then it just gets recycled and that's never stripped.
Yeah, water is something, you know, natural water, spring water, would have its own healthy microbes in it from the soil. I mean, the soil is packed with microbes. And so what we've done to our water, not only contaminated it with all kinds of, you know, antibiotics and other chemicals, but we also, to prevent infections from contaminated water, make sure there's no bacteria in it. So we've eliminated that whole source of bacteria that we used to, you know, feed our internal ecosystem. So there's a lot of things that have come. And, you know, writing my second book, I sort of narrowed it down. It's a period since World War II that all these problems have increased exponentially, as well as, you know, the consequences, the diseases, the allergies, the chronic metabolic diseases, you know. So we've done things to our environment in the last 75 years and continue doing it that is worrisome.
Yeah. Is there, I also remember reading something at some point about maybe a younger person who had been put on heavy doses of IV antibiotics, and basically their entire system was stripped of bacteria because they were on a very long course of it. And this might become gross. I don't mean it to be gross, and I'm not kidding, but they were given a fecal transplant to repopulate bacteria. And reading that, my thought was also reading a little bit about the different effects that these microbes can have on us, that there's got to be clearly a more ideal setup where you have the ones you want employed more dominantly than the ones you don't want employed. And is there any way to do that without having to undergo like stripping your system and repopulating it with the good ones? I hope that.
Yeah. So sense. This is, you know, so stripping your system, this is sort of what's called in ecology ecosystem restoration. So let's say if you have an area, you know, a forest with all kinds of invasive species, you first have to kill everything and then you have to replant it. So this is an ecological, you know, principle that people have employed in natural settings. It's been employed in patients with autism spectrum disorders. Because one thing, the ecosystem of our microbes is very stable, resilient. And even if it's a bad ecosystem, a bad microbiome, you know, disease related, it's still very stable and very difficult to change. So just taking a fecal microbial transplant, and there's different ways of doing it, some more gross than others. You can actually, you know, do this via pills. You could do it via an endoscope into your intestine. But generally, the problem is that they can't, that there's what's called a colonization resistance of our gut. It will not allow these, even if they're good microbes, to settle in our gut.
It fights them?
Yeah, it just, you know, the minute, I mean, give you one example. If you like probiotics or yogurt, these probiotics stay in your gut for about 24 hours. When you stop eating the probiotics and swallowing the pills, they will disappear. They will not be allowed to stay.
I like yogurt. My wife will make me take probiotics from time to time, especially she makes me, if I'm sick, which is pretty rare, and I have to take antibiotics, she follows it with probiotics. And she says, now we're going to regenerate. And I never notice a difference. And so I'm always doing it somewhat begrudgingly. But this is good to know. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yeah, so you bring up a good point, and I'll come back to the autism fecal transplant. But you bring up a good point. So there are studies even that this habit of trend to give a probiotic after an antibiotic treatment. There's a very good study that showed it actually delays the recolonization of the gut by your own bacteria because of microbes. But also, most of these probiotics, as long as you take them, yes, they will be around in your gut. But the minute you stop taking them 24, 48 hours later, they were gone. They're not allowed to stay. So in autism spectrum disorders, it's a different situation. There's a couple of studies now where people have treated these kids with broad spectrum antibiotic to knock out most of the existing microbiome, and then have done repeated fecal transplants every couple of weeks or so. And that procedure has been shown to be effective of actually changing the gut microbiome of these kids. Even after a year later, they could still see the new, you know, restored system. But in general, these fecal microbial transplants have not been successful. You know, people have thought, yeah, we can do this with people with obesity, give them, a fecal transplant of a skinny person, or somebody with depression, give them somebody from a happy person. These things work in mice, but not in humans.
Right. But you're also, I don't know what the case is, but with mice, you just said you're able to raise a mouse in a sterile environment with no microbes. So to me, it just sounds like quite a bit easier. You're never going to raise a human being that way. Is there an effect in the changing of the microbiome with the autistic spectrum? Does that have an effect there?
Yeah, so this has long been suspected. There were early studies where they showed that autistic kids have what's called a dysbiosis, or an alteration of the microbial composition. There have been many studies, haven't really shown a consistent pattern. But then there's also been experiments in mice where it has been shown that, the gut microbes have an effect through particular molecules that they produce on the autistic behavior and anxiety in these animals. The big question still is there a cause and effect? And in many situations, this is still the big challenge in this field. Do we have actually a causal relationship, or you could easily say, well, the microbes are changed because the brain is different and autistic kids are very angry and anxious and stressed. Their brain constantly sends signals to the gut and alters, the microbial habitat and their function.
So it could be the other way around.
It could be the other way around, or it could be a circular thing that both mechanisms play a role. So this has remained a major challenge, and as always, much easier to show these things in animals because you can do all kinds of manipulations, but virtually impossible in humans. And so we still have this big gap of an incredibly exciting animal literature and something that's takes tremendous effort and money and studies to prove that this plays an important role in humans.
Yeah, I also think and I talk about diet a lot, and I think it does come down to the idea that from person to person, the way we exist, the things we're exposed to, the amount of sleep, every little thing, the water we're drinking. So in a laboratory test, you can factor in all of that. And then when it comes down to real life, it's much, much tougher to say, this thing. Yeah, it's harder with people.
Excellent point. I mean, just, so we have mice that are genetically identical. They live in the same cage, the same temperature, same food. Everything is identical. And, typically in these mouse experiments, you can do an experiment in 7 mice, and that shows you a significant difference. In humans, you need thousands, before you can, and then you need, artificial intelligence to pull out all the differences and the variations. So it gets very expensive. And there are some efforts now of big consortia, international consortia, where you get thousands of patients. And I think that will move us forward. I always say, so in many ways, we sort of can influence like many of these diseases where the microbes we think are involved with diet. We don't know all the details. You know, we don't know like 90% what's in between the diet and actually the brain.
Right.
But in some ways, if you just are a practical person, say, we don't really need to know that. I mean, unless you want to develop a medication that you make money with, you know, to affect this. But what we can, what we know today, it's a combination of insights from nutrition research and from brain research and from, you know, microbial research, that we can influence in a positive way most of our so-called chronic non-infectious diseases in a major way. You know, so we could probably eliminate 80% of these diseases we're suffering from metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, if we just got everybody to subscribe to a healthy diet, you know. Yeah. But it will take decades and billions of dollars.
I become very pessimistic here simply because, you know, and listen, I have a daughter with type 1 diabetes, so maybe that's why I gravitated more towards autoimmune, and I was very interested in that. But I'm very thankful every day that the pharmaceutical companies have created all the stuff that makes her live a normal life, you know, because I remember when I was a kid having friends who had type 1 diabetes, it was a very different scene 40 years ago. And now my kid exists as just like everybody else. She has virtually no issues at all. So I am very thankful to the pharmaceutical companies for that. They have done a good job. Now, we could get into a squabble over how expensive it is. It's very expensive. But I also see, like, for every new physical ailment that ticks up, it's almost like a shady car mechanic where you take the car in because you have a flat tire and then the radiator needs to be replaced. And then you drive away and it's like, oh, it needs a new transmission too. And so this the way we do medicine here feels very much like the propensity is always going to be throw a medication at it. And then we're going to throw a medication at each of the side effects that the first medication had. And so I hope what you're saying is true, that we're treating a lot of this with diet. But again, where's that money going to come from?
Yeah, I do share, you know, even though I've spent my entire career you know, professor at UCLA, I do share your critical view of what's going on in the modern medical system. It is obviously, you know, extremely profit driven at every level. The things that are being most promoted are procedures to fix things, like a car mechanic, but not really asking why did it break or why, you know, why do we have these issues? Good example, you know, colon cancer screening. So it's a good thing that we, you know, screen people in a society where colon cancer is a, you know, a number one killer. But what has happened, you know, that the age limit for doing these screenings have come down continuously, you know, from the 50s, now it's in the 40s. If we wait another 10 years, it's going to be in the 30s. So pretty soon everybody is going to get a colon cancer screening. And this is obviously extremely lucrative for my specialty as a gastroenterologist.
Right.
So that's why, you know, some of my colleagues can make $1 million easily a year just doing procedures, nothing else. Instead of asking, why is this happening now? Why do we all of a sudden get more colon cancer in younger people? And there's very good evidence, you know, that this low-grade inflammation or immune activation that comes along with an unhealthy diet, probably with some other factors, plays a big role in this. So rather than implementing programs, you know, what we teach kids in elementary school about the relationship between diet and, I mean, there's so many things that could be done early on, you know, to make people aware of this. We just try to fix it at the end, where both the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industrial complex makes the most money, you know, and this is something that's really been bothering me tremendously, I have to say. And so this sort of somewhat course correction that I've undertaken writing books now for the lay public is really aimed at raising the awareness. You can do this in a different way. You know, you don't. And I'm also always reminded to turn on the TV in the evening and, you know, the commercials for all these immune modulating medications. I mean, every second commercial has to do with it.
And the ones in between are for food.
They're for food. It's amazing.
I mean, it's wild to watch. I hadn't watched a commercial in a long time. My wife and I were at a hotel and we turned on the TV and it was like, oh, this is going to be interesting because we haven't seen a commercial in 10 years. Food and medicine. Over and over, it was so wild to see.
It's like a Siamese twin, you know, those two things. You know, I just remember one commercial that I thought wouldn't exist anymore. I mean, we didn't watch TV at all before the pandemic, but it's it's gotten us like many other people. And so this is commercial about this, you know, completely unhealthy, nutrient deficient bread. I think it's called Hawaiian bread. And that something like this is still being advertised on TV. You know, they get a sandwich with 10 slices of this completely empty, unhealthy bread that starves your microbes. And then you see these immune modulating, you know, drug commercials. It's... Yeah, it's really shocking. You know, so it's
I often think about, you know, I feel like there's some general idea. If you said to somebody, you know, could you get a healthy meal at 7-Eleven? Maybe you're going to get a bottle of water and a banana, and that's as healthy as you get at 7-Eleven. I could be totally wrong, but I think that's a general idea that, you know, all the packaged stuff and chips and highly processed things are not truly healthy. But that said, we had Surgeon General warnings on packages of cigarettes long before, while the cigarette manufacturers were still denying their addictiveness or their carcinogenic states. And we come to 2021, and even with a terrific pandemic that wiped out so many people, unfortunately, the number one cause of death in America is heart disease. Mm-hmm. And the diet here is what I think common sense says is generally unhealthy, and still not a big deal to anyone, you know?
Yeah, so this is again something that I wrote about, you know. So this current epidemic, so we didn't talk about that epidemic of chronic non-infectious diseases that has been increasing, you know, for the past 75 years and is unabated, goes on unabated. So the reason that we don't talk about it is because fewer people die from it. You know, the life expectancy during the last 75 years has actually increased. In general, it's gone down somewhat in the US in the last couple of years. But it's because this massive investment of the pharmaceutical industry to keep us from dying from these diseases. You know, the prevalence of these diseases has been continued to increase, but the mortality from them has either been stable or decreased. Like cardiovascular disease, you know, we get bypass surgery, take all these statins, all these medications. So industry is keeping people alive and prevents them from dying, but is not really doing anything about, you know, the underlying problem. And so if people don't die, you know, it's become normal for people after at the age of 60 to be on a statin. So the guidelines for statins is such that pretty much 100% of people in Western countries should be on a statin after age 60. I mean, this is unthinkable. So it's become the norm. Nobody says, so we don't, you know, we can, once I reach 60, I take my blood pressure pill and my statin and a few other medications that become like the norm. But it's keeping us in this chronic disease state, you know, which keeps, you know, in some ways getting worse. And this is now with the pandemic, you know, it's completely forgotten. It's
not an issue at all. We all were supposed to only order our food online and have it delivered. And it's all generally fast food at that point. That was the way to do it. It was very difficult to diet through that.
Yeah. So it's, you know, people sometimes when they give a lecture, like among students, and so at the end, somebody asks, you know, are you a pessimist or an optimist in terms of where this is going to go? And I am an unconditional optimist, I would say, in general. I try to stick to that philosophy. But it's going to take, if you look at how difficult it was with cigarettes, you know, it's going to take a combined effort of a lot of different parties, from politically, you know, education-wise at universities, the curriculum for physicians has to be altered. So there's much more focus on lifestyle and diet than on, you know, procedures and medications. The positive thing is I think the younger generations are more aware and pay more attention. There's an increased popularity of plant-based foods, you know, certainly on the West Coast. I don't know, in the rest of the country, it's a growing trend. So I think there's positive and negative sides, but it will, yeah, it's going to be an epic battle. I think if you want to, you know, turn our world into a healthy version, what we could be.
Right. You know? Okay, changing course a little bit. Could we talk about your ideas around restrictive eating and fasting? Are these the same thing?
So in general, in the literature, intermittent fasting is sort of the catch-all term. I think that's not really correct, because time-restricted eating is not really fasting. You know, you can eat the same amount over 24 hours. You just compress it into a different, you know, time frame. And I mean, all these techniques, again, in animal models for 20, 30 years have been shown to be beneficial in these animals for longevity and for health. And in humans, the studies are just like all the other examples that we talked about have not been as convincing and not as definitive. But I think from a practicality, since we know that limiting the time of food intake to a certain amount of the day is feasible for everybody, whereas not eating for 2 days every week, yes, a lot of people can do this for a period of time, but then they say, oh, forget it, you know, this is just too much of a hassle. So the persistence of those habits of intermittent fasting are not, it's not very good, you know. So I think we have to go with the practical things. And I think time-restricted eating is like, you know, 16 hours of not putting anything into your GI tract and then compressing the feeding time to 8 hours is realistic. You know, you may not be able to do it on the weekend where you want to go out with friends and eat and drink till 11 o'clock at night. Or if you go to Argentina on vacation or to Spain where people eat late at night, it may not be possible. But for most of the time, and for working people, I've talked to a lot of people. We started this during the pandemic in our family, and it is feasible. It takes some adjustments. You have to stop, eating stuff in front of the TV after dinner. But like all these other things that you can't exercise without a good breakfast, they're myths. You know, they're myths that are trained with our kids early on in life, and then you stick with these habits. So we've demonstrated to ourselves, you know, we can go on long hikes before having something to eat in the morning, and you know, I have seen the benefits. I mean, the weight reduction, more energy, feeling better. So I would say intermittent fasting, all the techniques have shown to be beneficial in animals.
But would you prefer 48-hour blocks? Like, do the longer blocks show a bigger result or a bigger effect on the GI tract?
So there are studies supporting both. You know, there's studies that where animals are being fasted for, 24, 48, 72 hours. And there are studies where they're exposed to the same amount of food, in the animal experimental realm, it's called cafeteria food, with the rats or the mice, they usually gain weight on this and develop all kinds of metabolic problems.
Just like us.
But if that's compressed to an 8-hour period, they can eat that same lousy food and they won't gain weight and they will not develop these. So the animal experimental evidence supports the benefit of both of these. You don't need to be fasting for 48 or 72 hours. In humans, I don't think we have the definitive word on that, and again, I think the most important thing is, yes, there are some, and physicians that promote the 2-day fasting a week, but not everybody has that that mental attitude. And then, people have families, the kids are not going to do this. So you're going to feed your kids, but you fast yourself.
I mean, this is one of the big problems I've had too, having kids. They're all at an age now where I don't care what they eat. They can make their own food. But when they were little and I was preparing their food, it was impossible to make them the stuff they wanted to eat and not have some. I couldn't do it.
No, you can't do it. Yeah. So it's. So, I mean, the summary, I think time-restricted eating is a great thing. So I would say the best things, and it has been shown. So you asked about about the microbes. So that time-restricted eating, the time when your gut is empty, the microbes are in a different mode of production. They're not only a different mode of production of signaling molecules, but they also are, their closeness to the immune system varies between being fasting and eating. They're closer to the immune system when you eat and further away separate from the immune system when you're fasting. Another thing happens when you're fasting is you have these stereotypic contractions going through your GI tract from the esophagus to the end of your intestine every 90 minutes, like a clockwork, and they clean out everything that's including bacteria, for example, from your small intestine, where they don't really belong to. So during those 16 hours of fasting, you're in a cleaning mode. A, you're in a cleaning mode. B, you're in a mode where you keep your microbes away from the immune system. So that has all been shown in animal experiments. So it's in some ways a really good way for housekeeping of your inside, in many different ways. So there's absolutely no question. I would say if you want to do something good for your gut health, give your microbes long enough time where they were not dealing with processing food and interacting with your GI tract.
Right, giving them a break.
So combining, this is what I came up with. So this is another element, doing good for your microbes. So you eat your plant-based food all the stuff that you need your microbes to break down and nurture them. The second one is do this time-restricted eating, because that puts your microbes, again, in a much better interactions with your gut than if you constantly feed them stuff. So it sort of comes back to this recommendation, you know, what's the best diet? It's a diet that has the health and the integrity of your gut microbes first in mind, you know, and everything else will follow.
Right. And then they will in turn go to work helping the rest of you.
Which is an interesting idea. You know, this has something to do. I haven't come up with a good explanation, a philosophical explanation of why that is. You know, does it have to do that they are the most ancient life forms on Earth? They, you know, they know the best.
Right.
It's quite possible, you know, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it does. I don't know why every time I try to envision this, and we discussed, it's not something you can see. I know you can see it in a microscope, but it's not something you can look at. I keep seeing really like just wild alien type stuff. You know what I mean? Because I think about these networks of particles of creatures that are everywhere, and yet we don't see them, and they're in us, and there's a huge amount of them in us. It really becomes a wild thought.
Yeah, no, it is. It is really mind-boggling. And, you know, I mean, this is another philosophical dimension to this. So we were, as humans, we have this sense of self, you know, which our brain, I mean, I'm not a philosopher, but I've thought about this a lot, that our brain simulates this sense of self. So we have this illusion, you know, that we're separate from everything. We're the center, the peak of evolution on this planet. We know it all. But in reality, that's an illusion that our self creates. You know, I think you almost have to sort of forget this and say, okay, what else is out there? And what are the forms of intelligence? So I think this microbial intelligence, I mean, just imagine we have 20,000 human genes. The microbiome has been estimated to have 20 million genes, you know, so many more. And genes basically have stored information, you know, instructions, blueprints for building things. So and they're all interconnected. So there are in some ways a form of intelligence, you know, of a tremendous planetary intelligence. And they have given us all our neurotransmitters. You know, it all comes. They have first developed those, and so it's.
I always go back to Carl Sagan and his description of like extraterrestrials, and he's like, you wouldn't even know it. You wouldn't be able to recognize it. You know, like when I remember. Prior to all the craziness that happened, but when Spanish ships landed in Hispaniola, a lot of the people there couldn't see them because it was just so not abnormal that it was like, there's nothing there. We cannot observe this thing. And so Carl Sagan was talking about extraterrestrial life. And honestly, the way you're talking about it, I go like, maybe they're here and they're just, you know, tiny.
It is possible. Yeah, it is. So, it's a widely distributed system. If you look at, I mean, it's the reason our brain is so powerful, because it's compacted, you know, the cells are compacted and the distances of communication. But if you look at the microbes, they're all connected as well. It's just like these huge distances. And, so they're slower in their responses. They don't act like the brain, but I personally would not be surprised if it's a form of intelligence. Right. Who knows if it's ancient, you know, sure. Or
yeah,
but it's definitely something that's worthwhile thinking about.
This is amazing. This has been such a fun conversation and a lot to think about. Dr. Mayer, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I really enjoyed this. I've talked to a lot of people in these interviews, but I mean, this has been definitely one of the more interesting ones. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun. I'll talk to you again. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. And now for the Q&A. Sometimes you got to be dignified, Paige.
This is a dignified Q&A.
Okay.
From Cody.
Hi, Cody.
Cody says, love the show. Listen all the time. Question, though.
Yeah.
I'm a big dude, like 350. I was pushing 400 about 5 to 6 months ago. I get that no pain, no gain mentality, but oh my God, my hips and my legs sure do take a beating. Any ideas on how to treat the pain but mentally push further? I know, listen to my body, don't push my limits. I'm talking mental strength fight through the bullshit soreness. I appreciate you.
I personally don't think you should fight through the soreness. Now, let me say why. I love David Goggins and Cameron Haynes and guys like that. I love them and they get me fired up. But I've also, you know, torn a bicep. I have arthritis in a hip. I've had my meniscus removed in a knee. I've slipped discs in my back. Any one of these things and you're done. You're not pushing through that. And so I don't think we should be pushing through pain like you're talking about. The way I work out is I work out a body part and then I don't touch that body part until it's recovered, and not 100% recovered, but recovered to the point where I can work it out again. So, and I accumulate fatigue over the course of like a month or 5 or 6 weeks. And then I deload and I really let my body recover so that I can do that again. All of this is to say, do I go into the gym and am I ever a little bit sore? Yes, but it's never something where I have to psych myself out to push through. I don't think that's smart. I don't think you're going to get long-term success doing stuff like that. We cannot all be David Goggins running with broken legs. This is not something that I think is going to be a successful recipe for most people. So I would figure out where you can safely get away with pushing yourself. Now, if it's entirely mental, the amount of mental effort that I'm pushing through is a shitload. But I'm never at risk of damaging my body by pushing through that. So I think these are two very distinct things. And I think that's what I love about David Goggins and Cameron Haynes and those guys, is that they can get me psyched up to just get out of bed, to just go to the gym, to just make my do my meal prep. That's the kind of thing where I am pushing through, in literal terms, something that's actively stopping me. But if you go and do a heavy leg session at the gym and your legs are sore, don't do it the next day. I don't think you should. Let your legs recover. And I would say if you can't do legs again that week, you did too much. Pull it back a little bit. Take it gradually so that, you know, like, I don't ever get sore anymore, ever. I have to do something completely new to get sore. And I get exhausted and tired, and I could never do cardio after I do legs because my legs are shot. But I'm not waking up with cramps. I'm not, like, unable to stand up the next day. I can have a perfectly normal day the next day. I'm not going to be running any marathons, but I hope the nuance of what I'm saying is getting through. As far as working out and pushing through the pain, don't do that. I don't think it's smart. I don't think you should. I think you're setting yourself up for injury, and injury means you don't get to do anything in the gym. If we're talking about mental occlusion and blockage and stoppage, yeah, fucking push through it. Whatever you got to do, you know, again, I love David Goggins, who's like, talks about not being a bitch. Sorry. That's what he says. I'm not going to be a bitch. And it's like, yeah, I use that to go, like, I'm going to get out of bed. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to do what I have to do. And I'm not saying it should be easy. it should be difficult. You know, a workout shouldn't be like you're not doing anything. You should be doing something. But if it's, if you're running into physical pain, I'm not a fan of pushing through that. That is my answer on that. I hope that was helpful. If you have a question you would like me to answer on this podcast, please submit it to AmericanGlutton.net.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee, and as always, joined by my chaperone, Paige Dorian. Follow us on Instagram at American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.